From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we speak with international human rights lawyer Payam Akhavan, who says we place far too much faith in politics and not enough in our own choices. Then we learn about Janet Guthrie, the first woman to qualify for the Indianapolis 500, and the documentary about her career.
What's interesting about her is the person you meet today feels very much like the person you meet in archive. She still feels like, look, all I wanted to do was race cars. Everything else was secondary.
Plus, poet Lewis Clark talks about his experience as a Native American child growing up in the Catholic Church.
It was difficult, especially when they came and started teaching about Columbus and how the Jesuits came here to save the heathen savages. Then to find out that you're the heathen savages, that was a striking blow.
Lake Effect is next, but first this news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Payam Akhavan has seen humanity's worst. The international human rights lawyer has been a UN prosecutor in Bosnia, Croatia, Cambodia, Guatemala, Timor-Leste, and Rwanda. He teaches law at McGill University in Montreal and is a member of the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague. Last year, he was appointed to the panel of arbitrators of the World Bank's International Center for the Settlement of Investment Disputes in Washington. And yet, despite the state of the world, Akhavan refuses to sink into apathy or cynicism. Akhavan spoke at the Rotary Club of Milwaukee back in October of 2019 for its 15th annual UN Day program. He stopped by the studio then to speak with Lake Effect's Bonnie North, who wondered if the law was a big enough tool to take care of and prevent human rights abuses.
The answer is a definite yes and no. I mean, I think we need to realize that it has taken many centuries of intense and extreme violence to get us to the point where 74 years ago, we established the United Nations Charter and then in 1948 adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So there are obviously many very serious human rights challenges around the world, but the mere fact that we no longer accept the extermination and enslavement of the vanquished by the victors is something that we shouldn't take for granted, because much of history is, as Gibbon said about the crimes, follies, and misfortunes of mankind, we have an incredibly brutal past. So all of these victories, if you like, for humanity, for the progress of civilizations, have been won as a result of intense suffering. And it's famously said that those who forget the past are bound to repeat it. So we need to be mindful of how fragile our civilization is, our laws and institutions, at a time when hateful populism and conflict has really permeated political culture across the world. So my answer is that human rights law is not enough if we don't have governments and peoples that uphold those principles. Legal institutions succeed because they have roots in society and because they have political support for governments. And now is a challenging time for those that believe in international law and multilateralism.
You said it very well. We have a very brutal past, and it seems that as a species, we are determined to somehow destroy each other, that it is somehow built into our psyche. And I know as I read the papers and I listen to the news reports that it seems that the abuses are increasing. Maybe it's just that I'm seeing them more easily now because we're so interconnected. But it seems like all of that hope and all of that work has not done as much as we would like it to do. And I don't know if that's a fair assessment, but it feels like for every victory that we have so many more abuses happening and atrocities happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that perceptions are quite important. And we now live in a world of instant communication. I mean, imagine the world before satellite television, never mind the internet. And we simply didn't know what was happening halfway across the world. Or if we did, it would take quite some time before we became informed. You know, think about the Armenian genocide of 1915 in Ottoman Turkey. How long did it take before those reports of the massacres and deportations found their way into the popular consciousness? And also, we live at a time when we are much more sensitive about these issues. You know, it's really interesting. The Red Cross movement, for example, began during the Napoleonic Wars because of a Swiss businessman, you know, Henri Dunant, who went and saw the Battle of Solferino, and he was so shocked by the suffering of the wounded and dying soldiers that he began the Red Cross movement. Whereas in medieval Europe, no one would probably feel sorry for wounded soldiers because daily life was so brutal. So we live in a culture where we're now shocked by that sort of injustice. So I just think it's too easy to be cynical and to despair at the condition of the world, too easy to overlook how far we have come. Having said that, we need to take human rights much more seriously. And we live in an era where we are experiencing a kind of collective cataclysm of infantile regression. And we have this kind of retreat into a very narcissistic, isolationist behavior. Which is problematic not just from a moral perspective, that's, you know, our self-definition as societies that stand for human rights means that we should care about what happens not only down the street but also halfway across the world. But beyond that moral imperative, it's unrealistic not to care about what happens halfway across the world because we live in an inextricably interdependent world. Once upon a time, you know, poets and prophets would dream about the day when all peoples would come together in some sort of world civilization, where that is where we are today. And it may not be particularly romantic when we deal with problems of catastrophic climate change, wars, massive exodus of refugees, criminalities, the spread of pandemics. And, you know, I could just go on and on, global trade and so on and so forth. So today, it is utterly foolish to imagine that we can detach ourselves from the rest of the world. So human rights has to be seen not just as something which, you know, a group of activists should take interest in, but as the measure of whether humankind collectively is moving forwards or backwards. And the alternative to a rule-based international order, a global society in which respect for human dignity and the rule of law is the measure of how nations should behave. The alternative to that is, well, we can look back in history and see what has happened in times when we have decided that, you know, national sovereignty and isolationism and belligerence should rule the day. The results have been disastrous. But I think today, in the shadow of catastrophic climate change, in the shadow of mass extinction, which are very real possibilities, the failure to create an effective system of global governance is such that it really is a game changer. We've never in our collective evolution as humankind being in a situation where we could collectively destroy ourselves, not so much through, you know, just war and violence, but through creating a culture of greed, this, you know, consumer culture, which is poisoning the planet in pursuit of happiness. It is utter madness. And Arnold Toynbee famously said that civilizations aren't murdered, they commit suicide. And if we don't change our way, we are going to do exactly that.
How do we fight those impulses towards nationalism and towards that kind of populism that is opposite of what you're just describing? I mean, for the greater good, for all of us, for my individual good and everyone else, we need to be thinking in a global way. But it seems that, as you say, we are, or at least a number of us are pushing in the opposite direction or running very rapidly in the opposite direction. And so how do you fight that both an individual and a global scale?
Well, I would first say that, you know, there is a distinction between nationalism and, you know, patriotism. And I think it's very important to be globally minded, to also care for one's own community. So the local and the global have to be reconciled together. And I think part of the problem is that globalization has gotten a bad name because it has not really benefited people equally. Globalization has helped the obscenely rich become even more obscenely wealthy and powerful. It has helped a very select group of elites. So I think the public interests have had a problem keeping up with how private interests have used globalization to their benefit. So I can understand, in a sense, how some of the populism has now gripped the imagination of people, except that we cannot run back into an imaginary past. The idea that if we just, you know, turned the clock back and we went to the happy days in the 1950s, everything would be fine. Well, that's not going to happen. And that's why I talk about, you know, infantile regression. It's sort of like we want to run back into our mother's womb because it was a safe place. But guess what? That's not going to happen. So I think that this is a challenging time because for the first time in history, we have to define our identities in inclusive ways. We can't wall ourselves and imagine that we can, you know, insulate ourselves from what's happening in the wider world. And the question of how we can motivate the will to act, well, I think it exists at many different levels. I think there's an exceptional degree of corruption and cynicism in political power, in our public spaces. The media has something to do with that as well. Politics has been turned into a reality TV show. And people forget that there are real consequences. Choices have very real consequences. So I think now more than ever, empowering the grassroots and redefining the notion of power and leadership is absolutely essential if we are to turn this boat around and put it, you know, on the right path. And the right path isn't necessarily to go back to where we were, let's say, in the 1980s and 90s when, you know, liberalism and the market economy became globalized. The idea was, as Francis Fukuyama said, that we are at the end of history. And now we realize that that was an illusion. That was an illusion that our materialistic way of life is profoundly problematic. And this isn't about the debate between capitalism and socialism and those sort of simplistic ideological divides. It's about the fact that we've created a culture which, while giving us tremendous prosperity and freedom, is also creating widespread despair. Our societies are drowning in anxiety and depression amidst plenty. And in addition to that, we are destroying the earth, without which none of us will be able to live. So it's time to really reconsider the whole notion of progress. Is progress about money? Is progress about accumulation of wealth and consumption of goods? Or is it about a deeper sense of self? Perhaps we need to go back into our distant past and rediscover a sense of community, a sense of harmonious relationship with nature. We need to understand our place in the universe before we are forced to do so. So I think that we are actually experiencing a very fundamental seismic shift in our cultural consciousness. Imagine that the World Wide Web is really from 1991. Social media, which is now the sort of defining feature of the, you know, millennial generation, is barely one or two decades old. And to this day, historians write about how the Industrial Revolution was a turning point in history. Imagine what future historians will write about this time of confusion and chaos as our societies and our identities are, you know, radically transformed. So now more than ever, we need to have a deeper understanding and vision of our collective destiny, our common interests, and how we need to awaken empathy. You know, just as we have populism of hatred, why can't we have a populism of empathy and make that really the guiding force in social movements and politics and public spaces?
We're needing introspection. We're needing some time. And I was thinking when you were talking about taking things back to the grassroots and working that way, that that almost sounds like revolution.
Well, you know, revolution.
But maybe not a violent one, but a revolution.
This is the problem that, you know, when you use the word revolution, it always has, you know, many different types of connotations. But yes, it is a profound transformation of consciousness. And I think the most important revolutions are the most subtle ones. They're not the ones that happen with, you know, politics and violence. And I think we place far too much faith in politics and far too little in the power of our own choices. And the real meaningful changes in history don't come because of electoral politics, you know, electing party X as opposed to party Y. They come because people's consciousness changes. I mean, when you look at the Industrial Revolution, for example, how did urbanization change feudal society, which, you know, was about production on land, sort of loyalty to the feudal lord, and the idea that life was really, you know, about survival. So you look at how urbanization and the Industrial Revolution fundamentally changed our consciousness and how that contributed to the rise of liberal ideals. We forget that democracy was a radical idea. In the 19th century, the British politicians that were talking about one man, one vote, women were not really a part of the equation even then, but they were radicals, they were revolutionaries. So what is yesterday's radical idea today is commonly accepted. So we have to understand that the ideas that we have today, the conventional mainstream ideas, could end up in the, you know, a trash bin of history tomorrow. And that is exactly what is going to happen. So in that sense, I think that the disillusionment with politics is a good thing. I think people need to realize that our institutions have become so corrupt that in a sense, we need to look back at our own agency, at the importance of our own choices. It's famously said that all it takes for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. So when our culture is all about endless entertainment, instant gratification, constant distraction, you know, the culture of cyberspace, the internet, then we will get what we deserve. If we are indifferent to what's happening around us, we will pay a price for it. And I think there are very promising signs, especially in the millennial generation, of young people who are waking up, whether it's on gun violence or the environment or what have you. And they're saying that we will not remain silent. It's our future that is being destroyed by your generation. I'm included myself in that generation. And ultimately, that is how these profound changes in consciousness occur. So yes, we are in the midst of a revolutionary period, not in the conventional sense of how we understand revolutions. But I think that a generation or two from now, we will not recognize the culture that we're living in today.
I hope I'm alive to see it, because I'm hopeful that enough will wake up in time, as you say, steer the ship in the right direction.
I hope so, too. I think humankind has been around for a long time. And, you know, despite the fact that I was a, you know, UN prosecutor and I spent much of my work looking at, you know, genocides and mass atrocities, I also have seen the incredible resilience of the human spirit. And I think it's easy to be cynical. It's effortless to be cynical. And it's much more difficult to understand that we do have this incredible power to do good. And if we didn't have that power, we would have destroyed ourselves a long time ago. So I think we can do better. And instead of wallowing in despair, we just need to look around us and see what it is that we can do to contribute our share.
Professor Payam Akhavan, it has been such an honor having you in the studio.
Thank you very much.
Payam Akhavan is an international human rights lawyer. He's been a UN prosecutor in Bosnia, Croatia, Cambodia, Guatemala, Timor-Leste, and Rwanda. He's also a member of the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague. Akhavan addressed the Rotary Club of Milwaukee back in October for its 15th annual UN Day program, and he spoke with Lake Fex Bonnie North then. Coming up next, we learn about the first woman to qualify for and compete in the world-famous Indy 500. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Indianapolis 500 is one of the world's most famous races. 33 of the fastest drivers of open-wheel cars partake in the ultimate competition, and no drivers are guaranteed spots. Since 1911, drivers earn their starting place based on the order of qualifying time. It's obvious when you look at the drivers on the track that this sport is still dominated by men. But one woman whose name made history in the sport of racing is Janet Guthrie. In 1977, 39-year-old Guthrie became the first woman to qualify for and compete in the Indy 500. During the era of the Battle of the Sexes, Guthrie's path to qualifying was not an easy one. Surviving race to race was often the case, as Guthrie and her team dealt with mechanical issues, the struggle for sponsorships, and public contempt. Guthrie's legacy is not widely known today, but filmmaker Jenna Ricker is helping to change that with her first documentary, Qualified. It tells the story of the former aerospace engineer turned racer, both with archival footage and interviews with Guthrie's team and the woman herself. Ricker joined me in the studio last November to talk about the documentary and what it was like to work with and get to know Janet Guthrie. Ricker begins by explaining how she came to know of Guthrie's amazing story.
Well, I was introduced to the Indianapolis 500 as a spectator. Obviously, I knew about the race. I had listened to it on the radio as a kid and all that good stuff. But I went to my first Indy 500 race about 10 years ago and was blown away by the spectacle of it, the endurance of it, the crowds that were there. And so I became an instant fan. And then a few years ago, after my last film was out, we were on our way to the Indy 500 again, and I said, hey, who was the first woman? Like, just out of nowhere, I had this thought. And one of the other producers on the film and a collaborator of mine who introduced me to the race said, Janet Guthrie, 1977. So I started looking her up, and I discovered that she had written an autobiography, not ghostwritten, her, you know, pen to paper, and it was excellent. And so I reached out to her and I said, hey, you don't know me, Janet, but what if I were to make a film about your life? So this is my first documentary. So it was an introduction to that. And obviously, we do have the hopes to make the narrative as well. She had so much story that it's lent itself well to both mediums.
Definitely. And the world of auto racing today is definitely not the same world as it was in the 1970s. And you do a great job of painting that vivid picture with, you know, great archival footage. You know, I had no idea just how at the mercy of mechanics a lot of things are.
Right.
So did you have difficulties finding these primary materials that you wanted to piece the story together?
Well, it was great fun, actually, finding those things. So one of my hopes going into the project was, can we tell this entirely archivally? Like, we'll have interviews with our folks, but then I want to spend the rest of the time in archive. I don't want to reenact if we can help it, all that kind of stuff. And we were just so lucky that it was there. We had a lot to choose from. Then Janet had her own personal films, and her brother had films of, you know, that he would follow around on the track. So it was a gold mine. In fact, the hardest part was choosing what we had to leave out.
Yeah, what to include.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, the sports changed a lot, especially in the mechanics area in particular. I mean, it was so innovative back then. People like her, you know, her original team owner, he had a shot at coming into Indy if he built his own car. That doesn't happen anymore. so much money and it's much more streamlined, mm-hmm. similar cars, similar everything. So that was another piece of it that was really fun to discover was the mechanics. And then how much at the mercy you are. Can your car even make it 500 miles? So it's cool.
She was obviously a bit of an anomaly to be a female racer, especially in the Indy and NASCAR scenes, not necessarily in the recreational other lower level
races.
Right,
right. Not in the sports car. Right.
But she also had the advantage of a background in engineering. You know, she herself was the one understanding the car, helping to build the engine, things like that. And I feel like perhaps drivers even today aren't that involved.
No. And then, you know, some of them were, but no, they weren't often, even back then. And today, I don't think so. You know, there's whole telemetry. There's all this computerized stuff going on. Back then, that was just beginning, really. You know, so much of it, if you were to ask her, she would say it was out of necessity. Like she had no desire to become, you know, a grease monkey, but it was part of her reality. She didn't have the money to find crews. So she built her own, you know, her first car engine, her sports car, and it continued from there. But what was really fun was to hear from the people who worked with her, who were chief mechanics, who would say that they never worked with a driver who had the kind of awareness and ear for the car. So she could take the car on the track and come back and say, listen, I think it's the this on the that. And I can't even begin to like say the right stuff, but she could do it. And, you know, both of the chief mechanics that we interviewed in the film said, you know, you'd think, well, no, that's crazy. No one could hear that on the track. And then when they would find the problem, it would indeed be that thing that she heard or that thing that she noticed. So she had a real connection to the car itself.
And that was there from the beginning. She felt this connection, this urge to race, you know, it was her passion. She's kind of described as a reluctant driver turned feminist turned trailblazer. You know,
she just
wanted to drive.
Yes,
and
yes.
Being the first woman to do the Indy was an afterthought for her, but not for the public, for everyone else. So
yeah.
You mentioned she did write a book, but was it a challenge to get her to agree to sharing her story intimately? I know you kind of cold called her. So.
I did cold call her.
Yeah.
It turns out 411 is still a thing.
Okay.
So I think it was the challenge was simply she would be willing. It seemed as if to me she'd be willing to do it if we were to get things going. I think she'd been approached many times over the years, even back in the day. Hollywood came and bought the rights to her story in the 70s. Nothing happened. So I think where she's at in her life now was like, okay, if you really want to, I guess you'll figure out a way to make this happen and then you let me know. And, you know, we were kind of waiting on her, like, well, do you want us to? Do you not want us to? And then once we pitched to ESPN and they got excited about it and we're like, let's do this, I called her up and I said, okay, we're going. And she said, okay, let's go.
Let's do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Does she view her own story's significance differently as time has passed?
I think she views it. What's interesting about her is the person you meet today feels very much like the person you meet in archive. She still feels like, look, all I wanted to do was race cars. Everything else was secondary. What I think she will say is that she appreciates what it was now. At the time, in a way, she didn't. She didn't recognize. She was a reluctant feminist, as you said. Like, she didn't recognize quite. Well, first of all, she didn't understand what the issue was. But then she came to realize, like, oh, this is something I should embrace. I should use this as an example for other women, and I should appreciate that that's what it is. So it's kind of great to see her arc in that way, her trajectory of embracing it. And I think she looks back, look, she's not happy with how things turned out, and rightly so. And I kind of love that about her. I love that she wasn't like, well, so, you know, in hindsight, mm-hmm. there is no correct hindsight. You know, she got the shaft, basically.
Yeah.
And so I think she has accepted that life goes on and all of that good stuff. But I don't think that she says I'm at peace with the fact that I didn't get the shot I should have.
Right. I love how she refers to the roundy round boys.
Yes.
Like all the trouble and stir that she caused. But, you know, not only is the story a testament to Janet, but I also saw it as a testament to the independent team owners. And it's a very different picture today. It's all corporate sponsorship. Mm-hmm. It's all about the sponsorship. It's whose stickers are on your car.
Yeah.
And despite her having a unique story and having the attention and the other male racers being afraid that that would be a disadvantage for them, that all the sponsors are going to want to go to her.
Right.
That it was the opposite that happened.
Yeah. No, it was so interesting how I felt like on some level when I would read her, when I read her book and then I read contemporary books of the time and other autobiographies of her competitors, I felt at some point that they were just trying to find a reason. And that became a valid one because it was really starting to happen in the sport that sponsorship was coming in. And the ironic thing was you would think they would go for the thing that's getting all the press and all the attention, but they didn't, mm-hmm. you know, to your point. So it was weird that they that some of the other drivers who were against her would point to that. It was hard for everybody to get sponsorship, and it continues to be hard for everybody. She was just in a class of her own, so it was not just hard. It was a much bigger mountain, you know?
And yeah, it didn't living come race easier. To race.
Yes, living race yeah. to race. I mean, that's one of the things that is also really impressive about the time, the short time she was in the sport, that she has, in the short time she did, has a better record than contemporaries who'd been driving, you know, 5-10 years more than her. She didn't ever race a full season, and you're not going to finish, you know, and you're not going to win if you're not racing a full season. So that she did what she did, I won't say it, I won't give it away,
yeah.
but that she did what she did becomes even more impressive if you understand, you know, what racing is.
Well, and I was even more impressed by her and her grit, not just for one instance where she was physically injured. So first she broke off her arm cast so she could race.
Yeah.
She's driven on a broken ankle in a race, shifted with her left non-dominant arm
because across her body
because her right wrist was broken. I mean, if that doesn't show grit and determination, yeah. I don't know what is. Or wearing styrofoams on the bottom of your feet yeah. because your engine's so hot. Like,
I
can't imagine like putting yourself through that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. That's what made her a true racer. I remember when I was sitting with Johnny Rutherford interviewing him, and I asked him about, you know, the broken wrist and stuff. And he said, you know, he told me that at one point they had to duct tape his hand to the shift because he had broken something and he needed to keep it on there so that it went. This is what racers did. It was so important to compete. And there was a contemporary writer at the time, a well-known sports writer, who had talked about the fact when that information came out after that race that she had, broken a wrist. I think it was Al Unser who'd said like, oh, that was reckless or something like that. And he had won the race that year. And the sports writer said, you better believe if Al Unser did that, he would have been hoisted on people's shoulders and celebrated. Like, it's not fair. She's always being held to a different standard. And the fact that she was that gritty and that determined, again, like, it's very bittersweet.
Yeah, it is. And she mentions in the film, I didn't have a thick skin, I would deal with it. But to me, it seems like she did, you know, like more than that, more than just dealing with it. And I'm sure she was worried about just the day-to-day operations and how to make it work so she could race the next time.
Yeah.
But, all the criticism, threats, handling.
I mean, it was bad. Yeah. And her crew, she would be right out there with her crew. A lot of drivers, the way the qualifying works is you push your car up along the pit lane. And whether you're going to qualify or not, you had to do that. And so she would, with her car having all these troubles, you know, many days she had to be online moving it up, but not knowing she wasn't going to qualify. And there'd be all sorts of, like, vitriol being thrown at her. And she would go out. A lot of drivers aren't out there, and she would go out there and be with her crew because she didn't feel like it was fair for them to take it. But going back to that thick skin thing, I always love that line because I hear what you're saying. Like, it seems like, well, obviously she did, but I think that's what's so interesting about her. She didn't, and she did it in spite of, you know, like, she did hear all of it. It did hurt her. She did, you know, go back and kick tires and, you know, probably wipe a few tears away, but she was going to do it no matter what. Like, if that's what it took, fine, you know? And I think that's the difference between, you know, champions or people who are so that determined and the rest of us who might be like, you know, maybe, maybe not.
Yeah.
So
she also mentioned that women keep reinventing the wheel. She wasn't the first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was interesting, too. Like, again, it wasn't in the IndyCar, but it was an open car racing at the turn of the century, et cetera, where these women were, I guess, further into the turn of the century, but relatively close, were racing, and their history is totally forgotten. One of the other women that's talked about in the film, nobody knows who she is. And it's upsetting because if we don't know our history, it is like pushing the rock up the mountain one more time and thinking you're the only one who's doing this. And it stinks not to be able to feel like you have company or a mentor or somebody to talk to about it. And, you know, sadly, too, I think if you look at racing today, we're still dealing with one race a year for some of these women who are incredibly talented, who've proven that they could be out there, and the sponsorship still isn't there.
When you first knew of her story and had this image of her in your brain, and then you actually meet her and you're working with her and you're filming, how did that image change?
That's a great question. Well, it's so funny because I feel like I've been connected to her now for a couple years. I have to make myself think back. In her book, she really gives you a sense of her personality and her sense of humor. And she's a very, very smart woman. And when I spoke with her on the phone that first time, I think I was struck with like, wow, this feels like the woman I just spent all this time with. You know, it's a pretty thick book, you know, a lot of pages. But I think what struck me is she has this quality of like a desire to have fun and a lightness to her, you know, that even as smart as she is and as thoughtful as she is, there's still this little kind of twinkle in her eye about stuff. And it was fun to see that, you know, she would crack really funny jokes while we sat and interviewed her. We sat with her for 3 days in Aspen where she lives. And she would sit where, you know, you'll see her in the film. She would sit there for like these long, long stretches. And I would say, hey, Janet, you want to take a break? And she's like, nope, we can keep going. We can keep going. And at one point, the producer, Caroline Waterloo, had said, you know, I forget she was used to sitting in a car and doing this for hours.
Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. She's got endurance.
No G-force to deal with.
Yeah, exactly. So this is a piece of cake. But she would sit there. And then if we did take a break, you know, she would make some funny offhanded comment and have the crew laughing. And, you know, it's just... yeah. So you feel like there's more stories in there. And when she does, she lets them a little, you know, lets you in on some of those things and some of her more personal things. And it's a real honor, really, to be the recipient of that.
Do you know if she gets out on a track and just drives?
She's so funny. She had said to me at one point that just around 70 years old, she thought, well, maybe that her career, maybe she wouldn't have a career as a her career was over. But she did teach sports car racing to folks. There's a track up in Aspen. So she would teach sports car racing for a long time. And I think somewhere in her 70s, she backed off from doing that. But she has this great story of these two young boys. I don't know if they were twins. They were brothers, 16 roughly. And their dad asked Janet if she could teach them some of the driving skills and some of the stuff, just mostly so they could get an understanding, because I think they were wanting to go hot rod and do whatever. So she took them out in her Jeep. She has this Cherokee Jeep. Actually, she taught them, you know, this is the apex and the entry point, the apex and the outro point. And they were doing it and they weren't getting it right. So she said, pile into my Jeep. I'll take you around. I'll show you what I'm talking about. So she said one of her great highlights was taking them out, because they were definitely looking at her like, oh, here's this woman in her, you know, early 70s. This is, what's my dad doing? This is hilarious, right?
Yeah.
So she puts them in her Jeep and she takes them out. And she said they were hanging on to everything as she was doing the turns. And they were like, oh, my God, you know. So I can picture that so clearly in my mind.
Yeah, with a big old smile on her
face.
Yeah,
exactly. Loving every second of it. Yeah, so, and it took her a long time to go back to Indy after everything that happened, but it has been really nice to be there with her and see how many people are like, Janet, Janet, you know, calling her name. And you know, she's 82 now, and that's pretty awesome.
Well, and hopefully even more people will know her story and her significance.
Yeah.
Jenna Ricker, thank you so much for coming in to talk about it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Jenna Ricker is the director of the ESPN Films 30 for 30 series documentary, Qualified. I spoke with her in November of 2019 while she was in town for screenings during the Milwaukee Film Festival. You can find more information at WUWM.com, and you can also watch Qualified on the streaming services ESPN Plus and Disney Plus. We'll take one last break and then learn about one man's experience growing up on Wisconsin's Oneida Indian Reservation in the 1960s. Like Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues here on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The 1960s was a decade of change in the United States. The Civil Rights Movement brought intense focus on human rights abuses against minorities, including Native Americans. As the American Indian Movement was occupying Alcatraz, Lewis Clark III was here in Wisconsin, growing up on the Oneida Reservation and dealing with his own abuse. Clark is a member of the Iroquois Confederacy and the Bear Clan, and he faced difficulties growing up as just one of a few Native American children in his Catholic church. He dealt through it all with his poetry. His latest collection is called Rebel Poet, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about what it was like growing up on the Oneida Reservation in the 60s.
When most people think of reservations, they're thinking of like third world country things like in South Dakota, Pine Ridge, South Dakota. The Oneida, where I grew up, we were a reservation, but because of the Indian Allotment Act of, I think it was 1889, and then bringing in settlers in 1912, I believe we only owned like 3 or 4 acres of our 640,000-acre reservation. So when we moved right into the heart of the reservation, which was 1959, 1960, my mom told me that you were supposed to be nice to the Indians. So we had a curb and gutter, and I would sit on the curb and ask people who were walking by if they were Indians because I was going to be nice to them, because nobody actually told any of us that we were Indians. It actually wasn't until I got into grade school where I learned that I was an Indian. I knew my grandparents were Indian, but I didn't think that meant I was an Indian. And then when you start achieving in the arena of the white world, if you achieve too much, someone's always there to put you down and let you know that you're an Indian and you're supposed to learn to stay in your place.
In the book, you talk about growing up in the Catholic Church, specifically going to Catholic schools, and being really the only Indian child at these schools. What was that experience like?
Well, it was a great experience going to a Catholic school because the teachers, they wanted you to achieve no matter what. I guess the difference was that you always felt set apart. You always wanted to fit in. But yeah, it was difficult, especially when they came and started teaching about Columbus and how the Jesuits came here to save the heathen savages, then to find out that you're the heathen savages, that was a striking blow.
You describe your mother as being Haudenosaunee? How do I say
okay.
this?
that's the big thing that I'm going through right now because I just moved back to the reservation. They said I have to learn how to pronounce my words correctly because I used to always pronounce it Haudenosaunee, people of the Longhouse. I guess it's supposed to be pronounced Haudenosaunee.
Haudenosaunee.
And that I take with a grain of salt because it was my cousins who were telling me that, and sometimes your cousins always give you a little bit of a rough time. So I'm working on developing my Indian language. I've been away from the reservation for 40 years. We just decided to move back because there's a lot more opportunities for me as a writer as I move back to the reservation.
Yeah, that makes sense. So Haudenosaunee, it's another word. It's the actual word for Iroquois. And when I was looking this up, there's a lot that I didn't know about the term Iroquois. So who are the Haudenosaunee, and where do the Oneida sit inside of that larger term?
We were called the Onigiwa, is the Oneida, people of the Standing Stone. I believe we were on the eastern shores of the Iroquois Confederacy, the land that we occupied. And the Iroquois Confederacy was basically, in the beginning, 5 tribes, and it was can't pronounce this, his name, Dekauwanida, the peacemaker, came and showed us if you take a bunch of arrows and tie them together, it's very difficult to break. Whereas if you take one arrow and break them individually, it's easy to break. So the five tribes, Onondaga, Tuscarora, Seneca, Mohawks, and the Oneidas, all formed together. What the English called us when they got there was a confederacy. We were all along the East Coast, as far down as Georgia and as far up into Canada, and as far west as Ohio River, I believe. Our Oneida language is a language unto itself, I believe. I don't speak it, but I'm going to start learning it as I move back to the reservation. And I don't think there's too many of us that really speak it completely nowadays. But the wonderful thing is that since 1968, we have been buying back our land, buying back our reservation. We have a school. We're teaching it to our young people in the school. We have a health center. We have very many things going for us. The Oneida people, when they came to Wisconsin and throughout our history, been known as a people who believed in schooling. Five of the first 38 students at Lawrence University in Appleton in 1848 were Oneida students, Oneida tribal members. After being away from Oneida for 40 years, I'm just amazed at the wonderful things that they've done in Oneida, the housing, the taking care of the elders, the health center, just wonderful things that they've done.
You know, as you've mentioned here, you were away for 40 years, and it seemed like, at least in reading your book, that part of that was because of really the difficulties that you faced growing up. Whether it was, yes, feeling a little separate from your classmates, but there was a lot of trouble in your home.
Well, there was a lot of trouble in my home. So when I was growing up, what I encountered seemed normal. It's just the way you made it through life. My dad was in World War II, and he was decorated. He was in 42 battles, and then he was called back to fight in Korea, and that's the only time he ever talked about any fighting. He said he had to run landing barges, and seeing the kids get blown back once he lowered the doors, he said that was the worst thing in his life. And then my mother, in the 1940s, she had dreams. She won an art contest in the 1940s where Mrs. Roosevelt came and gave her the prize. She wanted to go to school. She played baseball like a league of our own. I don't know if she was actually on one of the teams, but she traveled all over the Midwest playing baseball. But then, just like happened to women all over the United States, the men came home from World War II and the women were pushed to the back of the bus. And being an Indian and being a woman was double jeopardy. So she was a cleaning lady, a waitress. Nothing that was fulfilling her. But she went to school continually. And when you're constantly not achieving what you dream of, alcohol overcame our house.
A big way that you've dealt with different issues is through writing. Why did you start writing poetry?
My sister, she had one cassette and a cassette player, and it was Paperback Writer by the Beatles. And I would play it continuously. And then the monkeys came into view. And, of course, thinking we could do anything, two of my friends and I formed a little garage band, and we were terrible, but we had the guts to try. And I realized that once hearing my voice on tape that I didn't think I could sing that well. But I just loved to write and put it together. And then sixth grade, we had a poetry section in school. And I started writing these poems with the repeating words, and I started writing songs, and then people started teasing me and beating me up and that kind of stuff. But it was a release for me, and so I just kept writing continually. I'd write, and in my head I'd write. I'd have stories put away there, and I'd have poetry put away there. When we left the reservation to go to college, I thought I'd take a couple poetry classes. And basically, I was taught that what I write wasn't poetry. At that time, you weren't supposed to write about your soul. And you don't rhyme. And in my head, I heard cadence. Not the Indian cadence that they go boom, 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 boom. But just a boom, 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 like your heartbeat. And so I just kept writing, and I wrote in a cadence. I just started writing for me. It was a release because I could write a poem about something that really hurt, and I could throw it away or I could stash it away. And then it was like a cleansing of my soul. I always kept writing. And then I saw an ad in the newspaper send us 5 poems and they didn't ask for money. So I sent it. And then they called and said, would you send us 5 more? They didn't ask for money. And then they called and it was a Mr. James Perrins, who happened to be Judge Perrins, the president of the Packers' grandson. And he was in the head of the English department at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. He said, I like your stuff. He says, I like to publish it. I said, well, what's the catch? And he says, there's no catch. He says, you just have to go and start sharing your stuff. He says, what you have, people need to hear. So I did. I just started going on sharing it, and little by little, I went from 20-minute speaking engagements to an hour speaking engagements. Somebody said, why don't you turn your speech into a book? I turned the speech into a book. I sent it down to Arkansas, and the new head of the department said, this has to be published somewhere. It was one of the most unique and creative things he had ever seen. So I sent it to the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. They brought me down there and said, we don't accept manuscripts like this. And so, you know, you're standing there with one tear coming down your cheek wondering, why am I here then? And they go, but what you wrote is different. And we believe it has a social significance. They offered to publish it and they did. And I guess it's been quite successful. It's helping people understand. And that's what it's about now. I want to share the truths and the hurts that I endured, so maybe somebody else will not have to endure it or know somebody else shares that with them. So that's why I publish. I write to cleanse my soul, but I publish to hopefully help other people.
Lewis Clark III is the author of Rebel Poet, More Stories from a 21st Century Indian. Clark was raised on Wisconsin's Oneida Indian Reservation, and he's a member of the Iroquois Confederacy and the Bear Clan. He spoke with Lake Fexjoy Powers. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. That's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.